And here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode number 74. Who are we? What do we do? We are a number of Seattle's film critics, and for years had gathered in theaters discussing film before the films, and now we bring that conversation to you in podcast form. I'm Adam Gerke, Sarah Michelle Fetters, Steve Reeder. And, you know, it's one of those moments we are on the precipice of our lives being taken away from us for the next month. Because
it's already started.
It's already begun. Yes. For those of us critics. The Seattle International Film Festival, the wheels are a-turning.
Starts next week on the 17th.
Yeah. So we have been already busy watching many things. Our eyeballs are starting to smoke just a little bit. We'll have Beth Barrett in from the Seattle International Film Festival
coming up here
in just a little bit. She's fantastic. But in the meantime...
We should probably talk about stuff from last week.
Sure. And to that end, Diablo Cody and Jason Reitman have a little film called Tully, by the way.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
They're back. For the first time since 2011's Young Adult, star Charlize Theron, who also produces, reteams with, like you just said, director Jason Reitman and screenwriter Diablo Cody for Tully. And it's, on the surface, it's a very basic comedy drama about a... early 40-something mother with two kids, an unexpected third child on the way. She's at her wit's end. She's overworked. She's overstressed. She's all the things that you would expect a mom in this situation to be. And her ultra-rich brother gets her the gift of a night nanny. Mm-hmm. Who she doesn't necessarily want.
And a member of the Duplass class.
That's a Mark Duplass, right?
Yes, that's him. Yeah. And he's very good. Mm-hmm. It's a small role, but it's a very important one, and he does it really well. The level of smarm and charm and compassion that is there is quite endearing, I think, in my opinion. But, you know, initially, our main character, she isn't really particularly interested, Marlo. She's not really interested in this night nanny nonsense. And then she realizes after she has the birth of her third child, her little daughter, I'm losing it. Mm-hmm. I'm going out of my gourd. And so she brings in Tully, played by Mackenzie Davis, to take care of things in the evening. What could be a very twee little melodrama about a pixie magic nanny coming in to save the day, in the hands of Cody, Theron, and Reitman, proves to be anything but. This is a very honest, authentic, eviscerating, sometimes tragically heartbreaking drama about motherhood, about family, about marriage, about postpartum depression. It's all of these things all wrapped into just this one mesmerizing time capsule, and you can't take your eyes off of it. I don't know about the two of you. I love this movie. I almost think this movie is pretty much guaranteed to end up on my top 10 of the year. I always hate to say that this year early in the year. But I cannot get this movie out of my head. And Charlize Theron, who is a gifted actress, has given one of my absolute favorite performances of hers.
And I think you might want to start biting your tongue because we're into May now. So we're not in January form anymore. We're getting along. But I would agree with you. I think this sits in my top of my list right now as films that make me think, films that make me laugh, films that engage in a way that I can't get out of my head for a while. And those are the ones that really I like the most. I'm also curious, I would love to talk to Diablo Cody about this, because when she wrote Juno, she was basically writing herself.
Yes.
When she's writing Tully, you can tell it's her dialogue. You can tell it's her whip smart in, you know, is she writing herself in
this
too?
She is. Apparently, this was after the birth of her latest child, and this was stuff she was going through, much like Young Adult is also very autobiographical. And you can tell that in Cody's scripts. I mean, even when you look at Jennifer's Body, which I know people have differing opinions on, Karen Kasuma's, I think now that we've had the gift of time, is a far smarter and more perceptive horror film than I think people originally gave it credit for. But if you look at Diablo Cody's writing, she is a smart little cookie.
Yeah.
I would add the primacy of humor once again to the story. There's one line of dialogue, dark, sardonic humor from Marlowe's character, Charlize Theron, that stands out to me. She's commenting about her outlook on life after just giving birth to her third child, and she says, "My outlook on life is as dark and black and cold as my empty womb." And I'm thinking, okay, that's what's keeping it real here. And by the way, connections and autobiography, Charlize Theron read the script and fell in love with it shortly after adopting her second child, a daughter.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, and what I love so much about Charlize Theron, for an actress who is as undeniably gorgeous as she is, still in her, you know, in her early 40s, who can, when you look at her in Mad Max Fury Road or Atomic Blonde, can look like the most balletic, kick-ass supermodel you have ever seen in your entire life. She is absolutely unafraid to look her age on camera. Mm-hmm. And I love watching her performances. She actually, in her dramatic and in her comedy work, she ages with her characters, and she doesn't care what audience perception is.
She's honest about it. She's very she's very upfront and honest. The other thing I really like about this film is it likens to several films, and I'll leave the films out of the question, but I'll put the book that this makes me immediately think of, and I don't know if this will ring any bells for you, but Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. To me, which
I could see that
there is, if you're familiar with the book, which back from the 70s, Robert M. Pearsig wrote this book, and it's a college professor who's basically chasing himself across the desert, not the desert, but across the country, the western part of the U.S. on a motorcycle, telling these Chautauquas or stories discussing quality, and he's having conversations with his son and himself, and it's a very introspective piece, and I find this to be very introspective in that same way. And the whole time he's also experiencing the fact that he's been under ECT treatment, which is electroshock therapy, so he's seeing things that they're from a different perspective, but were originally him, you know, several years previous.
Well, and this is a case of a character who is dealing with so much stress and so much exhaustion, and and as we talked about, that postpartum depression, and also difficulties in her marriage that everybody pretty much goes through, that in a way experiences some of those same things. So I can kind of see the analogy.
Yeah. A beautiful film, though, overall.
Allow me to quibble slightly, though, here.
Sure.
There is a big reveal, capital B, capital R, in this film.
Yeah, and how much you enjoy this movie is how much you're going to accept that reveal.
If you're a mother and listening to us right now, you may well get to the point at which you understand the big reveal. You anticipate it sooner than some of us did sitting through the film for the first time. One of the strengths of Reitman as a director and Cody as a writer, in my estimation, is that they keep it real, as Sarah suggested, that they keep it authentic, that they keep it grounded through authentic performances and through humor, even in the darkest of moments. There is, however, for me, one overly, unnecessarily melodramatic moment near the end of this picture that I don't think is necessary to the story and troubles me. It does help pave the way for the big reveal, but I find it stands out to me. It's the wrong tone, the wrong kind of scene to tell this wonderful story, which otherwise I think is exceedingly well done.
See, and that, you know, and I agree that others will feel the same way that you do. It is a moment. It is the pinnacle moment in the film where somebody is going to say to themselves, I absolutely love this movie, or I have a few reservations, or there are people that are just going to turn on it. My rebuttal would be what happens actually makes sense, especially once you get the reveal and you understand where Marlo is in her life. I also think all of the clues, I mean, this is, in some ways, this is also, this movie is very much like The Usual Suspects or The Sixth Sense, in that all of the clues are there. You can put all these pieces together.
Yeah. So where are we coming in on this? Big reveals or not? Theater, rent, skip, Steve?
Definitely see it in the theater. It is one of the best narrative dramatic features we've had so far this year.
And Sarah, how about you?
The only movie this year I've liked more is Paddington 2. See this movie in a theater. See it right away.
Okay. And I'm with you on the theater factor as well for that. Breaking In. This is another film that's...
this opens this week.
Yeah. Not necessarily a Mother's Day inspired, shall we say. I'm assuming here I did not have a chance to see this, but...
But it's a movie about a mom.
You and Steve did get a chance to see this. Steve, tee this one up for us.
All right. I would start with the director here, the Australian James McTeague. He's done a lot of work as an assistant with the Wachowskis, for example. But here, he follows through as the director. He started doing that, really came to notice with V for Vendetta a decade plus ago. And he's directing a tidy little genre picture. The problem with the picture, despite a good performance in the lead role by Gabrielle Union, is that it doesn't have any of the required elements to allow it to be distinct within its genre. It's a home invasion movie. It's a mother trying to fight for her kids, a survival story. It's a claustrophobic little story. It's a paranoid story. Think of Funny Games and so many others we could cite.
And it's in almost real time.
In almost real time, exactly. In almost real time, because we have to, the invaders have to realize their goal within a fixed amount of time, 90 minutes here.
Oh.
So basically, we have a woman and her two kids isolated at a home outside of Lake Constance, Wisconsin, an upscale African-American family.
Okay.
That does cause it to stand out in the genre.
Totally.
And the criminals, led by Billy Burke, talented actor, not given much to do here, but a talented actor, this gang of four invade, take hostages, and basically we have what I would call a geometrical story. The director and the writer has to get certain characters outside the house and other characters back in, and vice versa. She, using her initiative, her innovative qualities, she tells us several times, and so do other characters, you don't know what I'm capable of, has to try to save the kids. That's fine. These are all perfectly legitimate, even timely, topical elements. An African-American-centric story in that respect, in terms of the family. Maternal instincts, motherly love, fight for survival, female empowerment. The problem is, again, it doesn't raise the genre. There is nothing distinctive we really learn, except for the most superficial aspects about the invaders, the home invaders. And although we get teases about her character, Sean, Gabrielle Union's character, and about her family history, we never really learn enough to make us care, to make the movie have an edge and really come into focus. We're just going room to room, inside and out, a few nice stunts, but I just thought it kind of languished in genre territory without ever really rising above it.
Sarah?
Steve liked it more than I did. Hey, you know what? I will say
I could go lower, I guess.
I I will say Gabrielle Union in this movie proves she needs better roles. I've always said that she's very talented. I wish that she got better roles, and I think she is outstanding in this movie. There's a scene in the film where she's actually interrogating one of the home invaders out in the forest. And just her physicality as she's listening to what he is telling her in this moment, watching her go through, like, she goes through like four or five different emotional transitions in this one scene, pretty much non-verbally. And the way she like moves her shoulders, the way she just, her body, just her body language in general.
The way she crouches
exactly,
several times.
I mean, she's just superb. This movie's terrible. Ryan Engel's script is just a mishmash of different genre cliches and tropes that never fit together. On top of that, it's almost like this movie is like at times some weird combination of an exploitation film, like a 70s I Spit on Your Grave, mixed with some, you know, Humphrey Bogart film like The Petrified Forest or The Desperate Hours. And yet you never care about any of it. I mean, saying Billy Burke is wasted, that's being kind. He is the most nondescript, smart, intelligent villain I've seen in ages. And at this point, I mean, it's always been a rumor that James McTeague really didn't direct V for Vendetta, that the Wachowski sisters did. People have been saying forever that, you know, oh yeah, James McTeague was just there as a figurehead. It was actually the Wachowskis that made that movie. I never put any, you know, it's like the same thing when people say Toby Hooper didn't direct Poltergeist, Spielberg. Sure. I don't put any credit in those things. At this point, looking at James McTeague's filmography and what he has handled just from a cinematic perspective, you know, looking at Ninja Assassin and some of the other films he's made, I'm starting to believe it. I mean, the blocking, the way things get edited, the way the just the pacing. This is a real-time 85-minute thriller that is glacially paced. There is no tension at all. It just didn't work for me. I mean, the only elements that worked for me were Union's performance and Cece DiStefano's production design.
So you're saying we're going to love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I just do not think it is good at all.
So you put this in the skip category, or is this a rental category?
Oh, I would flat, I mean, unless you are the biggest Gabrielle Union fan on the face of the planet, I would, it's, as great as I think she is in it, it's a skip.
Okay. And Steve, how about you?
I would have to say skip, unless you want to catch it on late night cable at 3 a.m. 6 months from now.
Boy, that's tough. That would be a Red Bull night for me, unfortunately. So yeah, and that'll be a pass, I guess. But I can't vote because I didn't see it.
That's all right.
That brings us to The Life of the Party. So the other Mother's Day flick this weekend. So here's the story. You've got basically a mother and father dropping off their daughter at college when mother, who's played by Melissa McCarthy, basically is told, I want a divorce, which turns her world upside down. And she's kind of left holding the pieces, trying to figure out what she's going to do with herself. She dropped out of college with her final year incomplete and now gets the idea that maybe I should go back to school, finish that archaeology degree. And trouble is, though, I mean, it sounds great. Trouble is that her daughter happens to be attending the very college that she wants to be attending. So
and it's her senior year.
And it's her senior year. So it's both our senior year. Mom, how can you be here at the same time as me? Wait a minute. You're making friends with all of my sorority sisters. How does that work? It all kind of spins into a giant, and what's this? Who's this young buck who rolls on the scene and happens to take an interest in her? So how could we have a 22-year-old young buck interested in this mid-40s old woman? How could this possibly be? This is all put together. Life of the Party, where does it end? I think it's telegraphed from start to finish. We know exactly where this boat is going before it's left. And this is by director Ben Falcone and written by Ben Falcone and Melissa McCarthy.
Who are married.
This is their third film at this. This is their third go-around on this. I'm just going to be quick to the point on this. McCarthy's humor is, when done by herself, is often slapstick. It's often very, it's deprecating. It's harmless. It's not mean-spirited, and it is often, usually at her own expense, I guess. So yeah, self-deprecating. I found this film to be full of peaks and valleys, and unfortunately more valleys than peaks when it comes to the comedic level that this could have risen to. So to me, I sat here for 90 minutes, hour and 45 minutes, I guess is what it is, and walked away and just kind of went, I think I laughed out loud twice.
I think I definitely liked it more than you did. Mm-hmm. And I certainly think it's a huge improvement over both Tammy and The Boss, the previous two films that McCarthy and Falcone have made. Mm-hmm. It's not as ambitious as those two films, and it's not as boundary pushing as those two films. But those movies were so unrelentingly terrible, it didn't matter that they were trying to push so many different boundaries and delve into so many dark and horrible and pushing the R-rated button level of what you could stand. There's an innate sweetness to this film that I just was charmed by. I liked the fact that the sorority sisters immediately accepted Deanna, Melissa McCarthy's character, as sort of one of their own. There is a level of sisterhood and companionship and family that's at play in this movie that is kind of captivating and kind of wholesome and kind of nice and something you don't normally see in films like this. The movie is instantly forgettable. It is not something that's going to linger in your memory for very long. Peaks and valleys is a good way to put it. For me, there were a few more peaks than those valleys. But I mean, I can't get mad at this movie. I can't be upset at this movie. We were talking, I think I said earlier to somebody that to me, this is like the perfect sit on your couch doing laundry movie. You know, this is like when you're flipping through channels and it comes on TNT, you're not going to turn the channel. You're going to finish watching that entire film while you finish folding that laundry. Yeah. It isn't necessarily a movie when it comes on, say, Netflix or Amazon Prime that I actively hit that select button for.
Right.
And I'm not sure what the difference in that is.
This was a discussion that we had earlier. It's like when you are on Netflix, you are committing to something because you are pushing go. But when you are flipping the channels, you're not really committed to any of that. It's like, oh, and if there's a commercial break, I can just flip up and I can flip down. That's it. What catches your eye? Right. We don't have that stick-to-itiveness when it comes to channel flipping.
This is a movie that catches your eye when you're channel flipping. It's not something that I would say you're going to select when you're on Netflix.
Mm, yeah.
And I'm not sure what kind of compliment that is.
Yeah.
But that's kind of how I feel about it.
Steve, did you get a chance to catch up with this one, or is this?
I have not.
Okay.
I am familiar with the two previous films that Sarah cited, though. And again, I would say that her humor when slapstick is a little too broad for my taste, mm-hmm. because I think she's a much more intelligent actress than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, she's someone I'd like to see do some deliberately darker work, to be honest with you.
Honestly,
well, but Tammy
yeah.
was deliberately darker, and it was terrible.
Well, and but also, St. Vincent was another darker film in some regards, and she was a straight person in that. Mm-hmm. I actually like her when she's just a straight person.
Yeah, it was a great great performance in that movie.
Or when she goes dark, or when she's given a script that I think she hasn't necessarily written, like Bridesmaids, mm-hmm. where she's given some other material and they really give her some other tools to use. I like to see her in
Don't get me wrong, so. She's good here. Mm. I mean, she's the reason to watch this movie if you're going to watch this movie.
So were you coming in on this one?
Well, I guess I'm a rental, but I mean, it's not like I'm, you know, pounding on the desk saying you must rent this movie. I'm saying you're going to watch it on cable when it comes on randomly.
Yeah, and I'm more of the skip category just altogether on that one, so... there's another film that came out very quickly. Let's talk about this.
We should mention Revenge, I think.
Yeah.
It opens in limited release this Friday. And it's going to be playing at the Seattle National Film Festival. We'll talk about it more with Beth when she comes on.
Yeah.
But it's basically I don't want to go too much into it. I'm just going to say, see it. It's awesome. It's amazing. It takes the 70s exploitation rape revenge story and flips it on its ear. The director of this movie does an extraordinary job. She's a French Canadian, and I can't even pronounce her name. It's Coralie Farge. Wow, I just totally messed it up. I am so sorry. But this movie is freaking fantastic. See it, either see it in the theater or see it at SIFF when it plays at midnight, which is going to be the perfect way to see it.
Okay, so that is Revenge. That being said, the Seattle International Film Festival, that's May 17th through June 10th. Beth Barrett, Artistic Director for Seattle International Film Festival, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
This is year number 44 for the Seattle International Film Festival.
Yes, it is.
And this year, no doubt, and going to be containing a gajillion surprises and twists and turns, just like any good plot along the way, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
And so, it's also your first as the official Artistic
Director,
not the interim Artistic Director
no
anymore.
Exactly, no interim anymore. Now it's all really my responsibility.
Right? Do you get that pressure?
I get the pressure. It's like, every day. Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That's what it's about, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, good.
So this is all on your shoulders now,
yes,
Beth.
Yes, thanks.
Tell us, from the get-go, what are we expecting this year?
Well, you know, this year we really were looking at story. Not like other years we weren't, but this year we went into programming with the idea that we wanted to focus on story mm-hmm. and how stories are told and who's getting the opportunities to tell them. So we're opening with The Bookshop, obviously, a film about the power of the written word and about story that changes people. And we have, 43% of our filmmakers are women. We have a majority of directors of color because we are so international, 90 countries represented. And so all of those directors, all those stories that we may not have heard before are really given a spotlight at SIFF. We're also looking at the different ways story is being told in visual mediums. So episodic work, it's all just an extension of story. Short films lead into, series, lead into web series, lead into 7.5-hour miniseries. Also VR. VR is just one more way, VR and 360, just one more way of telling stories. And so, the traditional sit in a movie theater, experience the movie, that's never going to go away. As long as I'm around, that's never going to go away. But also, there's all these other people working in these other mediums that are telling these amazing stories and connecting people around the world. And we can't ignore that. We have to include that.
Yeah, that in particular, the 360 immersive experience.
Absolutely.
Is something. I was talking with a friend of mine who was doing a bunch of work for Microsoft, and I said, it's sort of like what's the future? The future is plastics. Well, the future, he said, is it's AI, AR, and VR. And so artificial intelligence, augmented reality, and virtual reality. So that is the future.
For some people,
For some people. And there, in fact, is going to be a whole symposium of some sort.
Well, it's the SIFF VR Zone at Pacific Place. And our friends at WonderTech have curated an amazing program of 23, 24 different pieces. Some of them are immersive pieces where you're in an entirely different world, 360 storytelling. Some of them are very tactile, where you're actually sharing and using all of your senses. It's just all ways of creating empathy and creating this feeling of being with someone else and experiencing what they experience, which is something that I think SIFF has always done through film. You know, they whole travel the world, be in all these places, understand things that other cultures have and that we may not know about. This is just one more way to feel a little more attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be fascinating.
I got to say, total coincidence and just completely random, I actually ran into one of the Wonder Tech techies at karaoke, of all things.
That's not a surprise.
I know. And between bouts of Kim Carnes covers, she basically tackled me and was like, "This is the most amazing thing you will ever see, Sarah. You have to go."
Absolutely.
Is she right?
She's right. She's absolutely right, because it's one of those, you know, we haven't had that experience here in Seattle where you can go into a room and for 90 minutes, you can do some of this, you can do some of that, you can do some of this, you can sit quietly for a second because you've just had a really powerful experience, you can go with a friend and you can both do the same thing and then talk about it. And so, you know, we've had some, you know, VR pop-ups, and I think a lot of different things have been happening, but this is the first time that it's been super available to the public. I mean, it's the first floor of the Pacific Place. It's the old BCBG.
Yeah. Yep. Wow.
So, you know, people shopping are like, all right, you got my kid for 90 minutes. I'll be back.
Yeah. So everybody can now be Michael Douglas in Disclosure for 90
Absolutely.
Minutes.
Absolutely. Yep.
Wow.
Well, everyone can be an auteur now for 90 minutes.
There you go.
That's how it works.
I'm also particularly fascinated about this because I really enjoy the theater experience with a crowded theater.
Yep.
And so this takes that whole connection and the connection you have with a theater when you're getting to see a film as an audience, as a big audience. Yep. There's something magic about that. I think this is fascinating to me to also explore this as well. So very cool.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
What are some of the other things that are happening here?
Well, we've got 432 other films.
Oh, just a few. Yeah, just a few.
So I'll just pick a handful.
But you're down from previous years. I mean, what's going on? Come on.
I know. I take the reins and then rear.
Yeah, hold that thought. So you've how many feature lengths and how many shorts in there? Because I know there's a separation in there too.
Yeah,
as well.
We have 243 feature length and 168 short films.
Right.
And then, you know, 21 to 25, depending on kind of what pairs down VR experiences,
sure,
which we're counting, obviously, yeah, because they're pieces of art. So, you know, within those 243 features, we really span the globe. There's some that are absolute not misses. Deborah Granik's new film, Leave No Trace.
Yes.
I know. Love it. you know, she launched Jennifer Lawrence's career many years ago with Winter's Bone, and this is no different. It's a father and daughter who are living outside of Portland in the woods, and perfectly happy, perfectly safe, perfectly. She's a smart kid. It's a great life until they get caught and have to reenter society, and they both deal with it really differently. And the just almost tender touch that that Deborah is able to use. Just it's sweet and it's sad and it's beautiful, and that the young girl has a huge career in front of her.
Wow. Okay. So that's one to start off with, yeah, then. In years previous, there has been the sifter, which helps people kind of reduce the magnitude a little bit to help,
yep,
them kind of send them down some paths to explore. What are some other paths that you found that are interesting this year, or that are compelling people, or where are we going this year?
Yeah, so we still have a version of the sifter on the website. You can choose. I'm going to be in Ballard. I only want to see comedies that are in Ballard.
Sure.
And kind of pare things down that way. The free guide, which is available all over Seattle right now, is organized by mood, because so many of our of the attending audience, just they go to one or two, and it's kind of like, oh yeah, we should go do something at SIFF tonight. And it's like, well, what do you feel like seeing?
Sure.
Do you have a creative streak?
Yeah. Well, I feel like seeing something about, you know, somebody who's doing something really interesting, or, you know, hey,
that might be Show Me the World.
Exactly. I want to see something I've never seen or learn something, or I just want somebody to freak me the fuck out.
Yeah.
And that's just, sorry, can I say that?
Oh, you can say that. Yeah.
You can say it once. It's a PG-13 show, so there's our one.
Perfect. There we go.
And it's a good thing that WTF, which is another mood, doesn't actually mean what you think it means.
No, It's wild, terrifying, and fantastic.
Ah, yeah.
Hey, maintaining the PG-13 rating.
Well done.
Yeah. I try. It's, well, it's my job
so,
here.
So we've got Exploring the World, WTF.
Open my eyes, make me laugh.
Provocateurs.
Love, provocateurs. Okay. Mm-hmm. Provocateurs is a big one because that can mean a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It can mean like an envelope pushing. It can mean something that is just really hard to watch, but is really important to mm-hmm. watch. Mm-hmm. It's a really broad kind of thing that I think is important for people to see, like pick and choose within those.
Okay, so digging into some of the actual films, though, specifically, like what is ringing your bell? What has got your attention?
Well, you know how I love Peter Greenaway. I mean, Steve knows how I love...
That makes at least two of us here. Yes, indeed.
Go. I'll say 75%. I'm with you.
Okay.
He's got a couple that I... Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to love all of Peter Greenaway, no. Though I find it easy. But
and
I can see that.
He is a provocateur.
He is definitely a provocateur.
Almost always, yes.
Definitely a provocateur. We have a film that was actually directed by his wife, who is a multimedia artist in her own right, award-winning artist in her own right. And it really is her interviewing Peter Greenaway through their daughter.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's through the effect of the alphabet. So A is for Amsterdam. B is for birds. And he explains how birds are an important feature in his personal life and his creative life and how he expresses that through film. And they go through the alphabet. It's fascinating.
Wow.
It's a fascinating portrait of a mind that is operating not on the level that we are.
Is C for cook?
Very good. So what's the name of this film?
The Greenaway Alphabet.
The Greenaway Alphabet.
He's already exhausted all the numbers, by the way. We previously drowned in those, so now we have the alphabet. Sounds a little bit less challenging, but that's fine. You know what's interesting about this, Beth, just another final word about Greenaway here, is that because he is a kind of multidisciplined talent, not just an artist, but an architect, a mathematician, plus a painter, plus a filmmaker, his films are always at some level about structure, a multifaceted approach to storytelling, and even emotive storytelling. So it's really going to be interesting for me to see another kind of structural approach from his wife, who is talented in her own way in this area, reflecting upon her husband's work, which takes it in a whole different direction. There's a lot going on here.
There really is. When he was here a handful of years ago, he actually said that he doesn't really like films. He doesn't like watching them. He just wanted to create paintings that moved.
I thought that was an incredible, I was there for that.
Yeah.
I thought that was an incredible interview that you just don't get those kind of insights usually during a Q&A at a post-film discussion. And he was just so open.
Yeah.
And so that's what's got me excited about this documentary is I just know that if he's that open with an audience in front, you know, right after one of his films, I can only imagine what he's going to say being interviewed by
his family. Yeah, it's incredible.
But, you know, speaking of provocateurs and, you know, crazy talented geniuses... Highlander with All Queen.
Yes.
Tell us about that. That is the most amazing thing I have ever heard in my entire life.
Well, you know, Queen is pretty theatrical. A little bit. And Highlander was just begging for a new soundtrack that actually captures the energy. And so DJ Nickfit, who's a local DJ, has done a remix of Highlander with an All Queen soundtrack.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where does this fit in the whole program?
You mean on the date? It's on a Wednesday.
Sure.
Wednesday, May 23rd.
Okay.
Yeah. 6:30.
Highlander at Wednesday, May 23rd. I'm making notes of all these things because these are things. Where do I have to be and when do I have to be
exactly.
there?
Exactly.
Where that fits is that cinema is not, it's not a codified thing.
Yeah.
Sure.
The experience of cinema can be a lot of different things, and it is really about the give and take between the audience and what's up on screen, and that can happen in a very audience sits, audience watches kind of way, and that can also happen in audience interacting with that screen.
Well, and just from this music standpoint, I mean, yeah, I'm getting all fangirlish, giddy about All Queen Highlander, but we've got the 1911 L'Inferno, which is an amazing visual masterpiece, but with a live score Triple Door.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't get two things that are more different and yet they fit together kind of perfectly, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a super exciting thing. We've done that a number of years now, is invited a band to do a live score because for bands, they get a different level of creativity when they're looking at a film and they're like, oh, I have to actually match that. And so they're able to really stretch what they're doing, and we're able to show these amazing silent films.
Sure.
With a modern twist. Yeah,
and this one's a lesser known, and it should be. I mean, to me,
everybody should know
About L'Inferno. It's such a visual masterpiece, in my opinion.
Let me just double check. What was the band who's going to be accompanying this?
My Goodness.
Okay. I was thinking just Goodness, which was taking me back into college rock years, but My Goodness.
She's
okay.
still around. Yeah,
she is, matter of fact.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Hey, I do got to ask, though. I mean, how difficult is it in this changing sort of landscape of distribution and exhibition and everything to actually program a festival of this size and scope and breadth?
Well, it's both challenging and easy. It's we have such a great reputation here that mm-hmm. distributors love to show their films with us because our audiences are terrific ways to really see how audiences are going to react. We're smart. We know our film. We love our film. And so we're in a terrific position that way. There are also a lot of films out there that don't have U.S. distribution that are looking for some kind of platform. And because we're such a large festival and such an internationally known festival, we are able to give those independent features that kind of U.S. platform to get more attention. And it may not be a distribution attention, but it may be, you know, people are now following them. People are now paying attention to what they're doing. People will, you know, tell their friends, hey, if this comes to your town, go see this.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned this a little earlier, though, but it does have to be kind of annoying when you have a movie, say, like Revenge, that great Canadian-French mm-hmm. thriller that's playing midnight, and then discover that it's playing for a week before it even comes to the festival.
Yeah, that was a challenging moment. Mm-hmm. We knew it was going to be on VOD, and we usually are like, if it's going to be on VOD, we're not quite, it's not going to work. But we were like, it's such a great feminist, like,
yes.
out there, mm-hmm. you know, directed by a woman, just, you know, taking that whole genre and flipping it on its head. We just, like, you just need to have it on the big screen.
And it's a perfect midnighter.
And it's a perfect midnighter, a perfect way to launch the midnight crew. But there was a slight miscommunication between the festival side and the distribution side that they weren't talking to each other, which made us very sad. But at the same time, the Egyptian Screen is the perfect place to see it.
Exactly.
At midnight mm-hmm. with that group of people.
And it's an amazing film.
One of the more really enthusiastic crowds is usually Egyptian at midnight.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I do want to ask, there are usually a number of celebrities or folks that are being honored or discussed. And I know you like to peel the curtain back slowly on some of these. Are there some names that you are willing to share with us?
I'm not excited about this at all.
Uh-huh. Besides Ethan Hawke and Melanie Lynskey?
I think those are... And the theater erupts. Yeah.
Oh, wait, sorry, I'll be quiet.
And so, having already seen one of their new films earlier this week, I'm even more enthusiastic about it now.
Yeah, yeah.
First Reformed. Yes.
Yeah, Ethan Hawke is spectacular. Uh-huh. So, I mean, the man is a great actor. Mm-hmm. He is an author. He is a documentarian. He is a narrative director. He is a screenwriter. He is really one of those Renaissance men that that I think we all are like, oh, yeah, Ethan Hawke. It stars Ethan Hawke, mm-hmm. whatever. But to be able to really say, no, really, I mean, Ethan Hawke. I mean, Ethan, it's not just Gattaca.
Sure, yeah.
But for me, it really is just Gattaca.
So, is it just more Jude Law in the oven?
Well.
the eternal debate continues. So,
but also Melanie Lynskey. I mean, there's
Melanie Lynskey.
And she loves Seattle.
I mean, Heavenly Creatures.
Yes.
I mean, just Heavenly Creatures alone. But the woman has not stopped working since then. Mm-hmm. She has hundreds of credits to her, credits to her credit, in independent film, voiceovers, TV shows. She was on 2.5 Men for years. She's done some amazing, amazing work, and she's so recognizable when she's there, but then she also is completely within characters when she inhabits them. And she does love Seattle. She loves Seattle filmmakers.
Yeah, and the thing about Sadie is that it's from a Seattle filmmaker.
Exactly, Megan Griffiths.
So
and
Megan
starring
Griffiths,
Sophia Matrush-Loss, who was in Lane 1974 last year.
Okay, so Megan Griffiths has got this, and that's part of SIFF this year
yep.
as well.
Yep,
so,
The Afternoon with Melanie Lynskey is also includes Sadie. And mm-hmm. so Melanie will be there, and Megan Griffiths, and Sophia Matrush-Loss, the producers, other of the local cast. It's a great celebration of the power of female filmmaking. I'm just going to go there.
Sure.
Like, there's something about Seattle and female directors that really is very powerful. And there's this voice that is coming out. And I think Melanie kind of captures that and encapsulates it as well as Sophia. I mean, she's someone to watch in the future mm-hmm. because her mm-hmm. role in Lane 1974 was spectacular. And she is just as good in
yeah.
Sadie.
Yeah.
Oh, she might be better.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've heard Sadie, I've heard Highlander, I've heard the Peter Greenaway or the Greenaway alphabet. If you had some other like top favorites that just are just calling out your name saying, Beth, tell the people about me, what would you choose?
How many do I get? So I'm going to start with Dead
right.
Pigs.
Okay, Dead Pigs.
Dead Pigs, Kathy Yan's new film, her debut, which is this really fascinating narrative film about gentrification and the speed of modernization in China, and a woman who just refuses to leave her ancestral home, mm-hmm. just refuses, even as everything around her is being torn down and decimated. It's also really, really funny. And at the same time, in that small neighborhood, all the pigs are dying, which is based on a true story in China. But what's really interesting about it is that based entirely on this one debut film set in China about gentrification, Kathy Ann was the first Asian American to be tapped to do a superhero film.
No kidding.
So it's just like, okay, how do you make that jump?
Yeah.
Like, and so I think that's super fascinating for people. It's also a really great film. Another one that I think is terrific is Amateurs, which is a Swedish film. About a town that is courting a big box store to kind of make them more exciting. And the town council decides that they're going to ask the high school students, because they have no money to make this video, they're going to ask the high school students to make a video about the town. And then they realize the high school students are like going rogue and they're making a video about what the town really is like. And they're like, no, stop doing that. And then they hire this guy to make a video about the town. And so there's warring videos. And what comes out is, you know, we think about Scandinavia being this, you know, open, the most liberal place in the earth, and that there are still these longstanding challenges for people who have emigrated to Scandinavia that is kind of coming out. So again, very funny, very topical, very real.
Don't we have another dimension to that though, Beth, in that if I recall correctly, the box store is German?
The bookstore?
The bookstore.
The bookshop.
No, I'm
the box store. Oh, yes, the box store.
And so here's a Swedish town competing for a German business to come, which adds another layer of kind of cultural complexity to all of this.
Yes. Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's fascinating. And in the video they come up with, you're like, what? This is amazing.
But what is happening? Speaking of books, though, I mean, what did lead you to choose The Bookshop as the opening night film?
It was really important to me to find a film directed by a woman. That was a paramount, because there are a lot of them that are out there and they're amazing. And then as we were sort of talking to different distributors, because, you know, McCaw Hall is a fairly large place. And so, you know, being confident that film was going to play well in a big house, we found The Bookshop, and it fit the things that we had been talking about from the very beginning, way back in the fall when we were looking at what SIFF 2018 was going to be, and it was going to be about story. And suddenly it was like, oh my God, Isabel Coixet's film, she's been here. It's Emily Mortimer and Patricia Clarkson are terrific in this, as is Bill Nighy. It is about the power of story and the power of a story to change minds. And so I was like, oh, well, that seems reasonable.
Okay, so if there was one more that you could throw in there, if it's a centerpiece gala or if it's a closing film or if it's tugging for one more.
I'm going to go for Eighth Grade. Eighth Grade, which is Bo Burnham's debut. It's a comedy starring Elsie Fisher, who was 13 when it was shot, who had just completed her eighth grade, and it is literally the very messy, very cringe-inducing last week of eighth grade in the mind and body of a really awkward 13-year-old.
We have all lived that, and
it is cringe-inducing, but she is so beautiful. She is such a beautiful, beautiful girl.
And the filmmakers will be here.
And the filmmaker will be here, as will Elsie Fisher.
Seattle International Film Fest. The 44th year, it's May 17th through June 10th. And more information, we can get that at SIFF.net,
yes.
Correct? Tickets, information, all of that found at SIFF.net. Beth Barrett, Artistic Director, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Always a good time at the Seattle International Film Festival. I've got to really get my fingers turning through the pages a little quicker on our guide here on the various different
directories. You do. There's stuff playing this year you're going to love. Yeah. I guarantee it.
Steven, you've been to a lot of the screenings as well. Are there things that we're allowed to talk about that have already piqued your interest?
Well, clearly the best film I've seen so far is First Reformed, which is one of the two Ethan Hawke films, one starring him, one directed by him, as well as acting, that are going to play the festival. It's outstanding. I will just say this much right now. It's not only rich emotionally, it's very rich in terms of ideas. It's a very intellectually satisfying picture that had a lot of us talking at great length after the press screening.
Sure.
It is a very rich, thoughtful picture. You delve into religion, you delve into environmental politics, you delve into activism, you delve into the meaning of God and the supernatural and the next life and humanity. And by the way, not only are Ethan Hawke and Amanda Seyfried very good in this film, Cedric the Entertainer.
No kidding.
Playing a mostly straight role, except for one very funny riff on a very famous piece of music by Bach. Not going to give you a spoiler on that. But otherwise, he's playing it straight as a senior minister, is exceedingly good in support. But it's just a very thoughtful, carefully, beautifully made picture by Paul Schrader.
No kidding.
And I got to say, Blindspotting. It's got David Deegs in the lead role. It's 3 days in the life of a moving truck driver who is on his last 3 days of probation and dealing with the gentrification and the changing all the changes that are happening in Oakland at this time, while also trying to just basically survive while black. Awesome. Awesome film, and David Deegs is extraordinary.
Sure thing. The big one that's kind of piqued my curiosity was Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is the Fred Rogers documentary.
Yep.
And I will just sum up and say this. There is something that is very telling about a documentary that is full of the theater is full of a room of hardened I was almost going to call us criminals, hardened critics.
Some people would call us criminals.
We could possibly be, but hardened critics. And I heard weeping almost in every aisle.
Yeah, I saw a few Kleenexes and
Kleenexes out. So
that's right.
This is a heart touching, sentimental journey. At the same time, also just a great reminder as to. The education we received as children. It really a very touching film. So,
and the power of public television.
Exactly. So Won't You Be My Neighbor. So, all right, in quick review, Sarah, other things that you're working on right now?
Just gearing up for Interview Palooza with the Seattle National Film Festival. I've got a bunch lined up. I'm also going to have an interview with Sebastian Leo up on the... on Movie Freak in regards to Disobedience.
Uh-huh. And Steve, how about you?
Well, Morgan Neville, who is coming to the festival along with his Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Yes.
And Wim Wenders and others who are going to be interviewed in conjunction with a film I can't talk about yet, as a matter of fact. but you asked about the project. There's one of the projects. There is a film coming to Seattle in the not-too-distant future directed by Wim Wenders. I can't say anymore.
Okay.
And he will be available for interview purposes. And yes, working on that project. And of course, for all of us, it's SIFF, the mothership, I think, for the next several weeks.
Yeah, indeed. So in quick review of Cinema Squabble, episode number 74, Tully getting 3 strong theater recommendations from the Squabblers, Life of the Party getting a rental and a skip, Breaking In getting 2 skips, and Revenge getting a strong theater recommendation, which you can catch at the Grand Illusion, or you can also catch it at SIFF.
Midnight, opening weekend.
The midnight screenings, like we said earlier, always the enthusiastic crowd. So, Cinema Squabble, episode number 74, Adam Gerke, Sarah Michelle Fetters, Steve Reeder, thank you so much for joining us, and Sprints Arbogast, our producer as well.